Usually when we think about how the world changes, we tend to look for the big, loud explosions,
Right.
like a building falls
Right.
or a dam breaks. It's visible. It's right there in front of you.
Yeah, the cause and the effect, they occupy the exact same space. I mean, it's impossible to ignore.
Exactly. But when you look at the real forces shaping our lives right now, it's actually much more like watching the wind. You can't actually see the wind itself, you know?
Right. You only know it's there because the trees are bending or, the roof is being torn off your house.
Yeah, exactly. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are so glad you are here with us.
Absolutely.
Now, looking at this massive stack of Friday newspapers we're about to go through, a lot of this is, well, it's highly charged, polarized stuff.
Very much so.
So just a quick heads up for you listening. Our sources for this deep dive contain politically charged content from a really wide variety of perspectives. Our mission today is strictly and impartially to report the original source material.
Right. Just the facts.
Neither of us here is endorsing any political viewpoints.
Yeah.
We are simply conveying the facts exactly as they were presented in the sources we've gathered.
We're looking at the landscape as it is recorded today, Friday, June 5, 2026. Not as anyone, wishes it to be.
Right. And what a landscape it is.
Yeah.
Our mission is to connect the hidden threads running through today's top stories.
From the bleeding edge of science and AI.
All the way to the fierce structural frictions happening in Washington, D.C. And ultimately, we're looking at how all of this trickles down into your everyday life. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
We're starting with how humanity understands and communicates complex, invisible threats. Because right now, scientists are going to some truly surprising lengths just to get the public to listen to them.
Yeah, I mean, the scientific community is facing a profound crisis of trust right now. They're finally realizing that just handing the public a spreadsheet of data just doesn't work anymore.
No, not at all.
Human brains are wired for narrative, not raw statistics.
Which brings us to this piece I found in the Wall Street Journal. It is absolutely fascinating. Over 35,000 scientists and researchers are currently taking improv comedy
This
classes.
is such a funny image.
It really is.
Yeah.
Professional actors are literally teaching physicists and engineers how to read a room.
Wow.
There's this fantastic scene described in the article with a neuroscientist named Annalisa Simemi. So she's normally in her lab working with mice using these complex instruments.
Right, very serious stuff.
Very serious. But in this class, she's tasked with pitching a completely nonsensical product called a hammer humidifier to her colleagues.
A hammer humidifier.
Yeah, she's leaping forward shouting, "It's the top-rated humidifier in Arizona, and it can be used for self-defense."
That is amazing. And, it sounds absurd on the surface, but the underlying psychology is vital. Science has historically relied on the sheer weight of its data to persuade people.
Just throw the facts at them.
Exactly. The mentality was the facts speak for themselves, but data without an emotional hook, it just bounces off a skeptical public.
So true.
These improv classes are teaching scientists how to build a bridge between, the sterile lab and the really messy reality of human emotion.
It's like a brilliant chef finally learning how to write an appetizing menu. I mean, the substance is already there, the food is incredible. But if the menu was written like a dense, overly academic textbook, you're not going to order the dish.
No, you'll go eat somewhere else.
Exactly.
And we desperately need the public to stick around for the main course here, because as the New York Times is reporting today, we are on the verge of some staggering medical breakthroughs that actually require public participation.
Oh, the lung cancer study. Yes.
Right. Researchers have just identified a set of blood proteins that can predict lung cancer more than 5 years before a diagnosis.
A 5-year warning system for the deadliest cancer on the planet. I mean, that is a massive paradigm shift.
It fundamentally changes the timeline of human health. A team of more than 80 researchers across 4 continents published these findings in the journal Cell.
Huge collaborative effort.
Massive. And if we look at the mechanics, they linked these specific elevated proteins to chronic inflammation. What's fascinating here is that they also found early evidence that existing anti-inflammatory drugs could significantly reduce the cancer risk in people with these elevated proteins.
Wait, so they already have the drugs to fight it?
They do. It's just a matter of knowing who to give them to.
Wow. So imagine if one of those scientists from the improv class had to explain this to a skeptical patient.
Right.
Instead of just handing them a chart of protein levels, they could say, "Look, these proteins are like a smoke detector going off in your kitchen 5 years before the house actually catches fire.
That's a great analogy.
We don't have to just sit here and wait for the flames to show up on an X-ray. We can bring in the anti-inflammatory water right now."
That is exactly the kind of communication shift Dr. Douglas Ehrenberg was getting at when he called this the missing holy grail of medicine. For centuries, our entire medical infrastructure has been reactive.
You get sick, we treat the symptom.
Exactly. Now we're moving toward intercepting the disease at the microscopic level before it ever physically manifests.
But getting people to care about microscopic things is incredibly difficult, especially when those invisible things are in the environment.
Oh, for sure.
Today's LA Times is reporting on a study from researchers at UCLA and UC Davis. This is regarding the aftermath of the Eaton and Palisades fires in Southern California.
Okay, yeah.
More than 2 months after those fires were put out, they are finding toxic hexavalent chromium still lingering in the air.
Which is terrifying. And this isn't just general smog. It's in the form of ultrafine particles, which are, get this, more than 1,000 times smaller than the width of a human hair.
1,000 times smaller.
Yeah.
That's almost impossible to conceptualize.
Yeah.
Michael Jarrett, he's an environmental health professor at UCLA, he explained the mechanics of why that size is so dangerous. Because these particles are so small, our bodies simply don't have a defense mechanism for them.
They just bypass everything.
Right. They easily invade the barrier of our lungs, cross cell membranes, and get right into the human bloodstream.
And it requires a massive leap of institutional trust to take that seriously. You really have to believe the scientists measuring the air. Because, you know, you walk outside in Southern California, the sky looks blue and the fire has been out for 2 months.
Exactly. Everything looks fine.
But if the public doesn't trust the messenger, they will just ignore the invisible message until it becomes a very visible health disaster.
And if we are struggling this much to track and manage physical microscopic threats in our environment, I mean, it makes complete sense that the tech world is suddenly terrified of the digital threats they're building from scratch.
Oh, absolutely.
The creators of our most powerful technologies seem to be realizing they might not be able to control their own invisible forces.
The artificial intelligence race has totally shifted from pure, unbridled optimism to genuine, jittery anxiety.
Yes, several pieces in the Wall Street Journal today highlight this whiplash. Anthropic, which is one of the biggest AI players out there, is actively calling for top labs to weigh slowing down the pace of development.
Slowing down? In tech, that's unheard of.
Right. They are warning that systems are advancing so fast, they might soon be able to improve themselves in ways that pose significant societal risks.
Wow.
And Meta has reportedly delayed the release of its newest AI model multiple times. Until this week, they didn't even have a planned date to let developers use it.
The panic has actually reached the point where senior U.S. officials are actively discussing having the federal government take financial stakes in major AI companies.
Yeah, the federal government buying into AI labs.
Yeah. This would essentially intertwine federal oversight directly with corporate governance. And it's an idea that was apparently pitched last year by OpenAI CEO Sam Altman himself.
Okay, I have to push back on this narrative a little bit.
Go for it.
Is this genuine caution about societal risk, or is this a classic corporate move? I mean, you build the most powerful tool in the world, you secure billions in funding, you get to the top, and then you suddenly say to the government, oh, this is too dangerous, we need heavy regulation and federal partnerships.
I see what you're saying.
Doesn't that essentially pull the ladder up behind you so no new startup can ever afford to compete?
The mechanics of regulatory capture definitely support your skepticism there. By helping design the regulations, the biggest players conveniently lock out their competitors.
Exactly.
But it's likely a mixture of both. The societal risks of self-improving algorithms are very real. But these companies are also highly pragmatic about cementing their monopolies. Just look at Apple's strategy, which the journal also breaks down today ahead of their developer conference.
Yes. The long-awaited reboot of Siri.
Right. Siri has been notoriously behind the curve for years. But Apple isn't trying to build a better foundational AI model from scratch to beat OpenAI or Anthropic.
They're not.
No. Instead, they're integrating Google's Gemini technology to modernize Siri, and they'll likely offer a paid tier. Tim Cook's strategy is brilliant in its simplicity, really. Apple doesn't need to invent the smartest AI, they just need to be the toll booth.
The toll booth, I love that.
They own the iPhone, they own the hardware infrastructure, they can simply charge rent for anyone else's AI to access their massive user base.
So they don't have to invent the car, they just own the highway.
Exactly.
And speaking of the infrastructure of the future, I was really struck by the New York Times profile on SpaceX today. Because while Elon Musk is dominating the news cycle, I mean, dying with President Trump, traveling to China, fighting Sam Altman in court.
The usual Musk headlines.
Right. There is someone else quietly running the actual mechanics of the Empire.
Gwynne Shotwell.
Yes.
She has been the president and chief operating officer of SpaceX for 24 years. She's the operational engine of that company.
The Times actually calls her the adult in the room. Over the last 6 months, while Musk is making global headlines, she's the one actually selling Starlink at a telecom show in Spain.
Doing the groundwork.
Exactly. She's the one mingling with politicians in India to open up new regulatory markets. She's pledging to the White House that their data centers won't spike energy prices for everyday Americans.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what we're seeing across Anthropic, Apple, and SpaceX is the tech sector realizing it has to grow up.
Yeah.
It's no longer just a bunch of hackers breaking things and moving fast in a garage. Tech is the global infrastructure now.
That's a huge shift.
They're realizing that their biggest hurdles aren't technological anymore. They're geopolitical and regulatory. They have to anticipate Washington.
But anticipating Washington is nearly impossible right now, because the actual rulemakers in D.C. are currently paralyzing themselves. Which brings us to the structural frictions happening in the Capitol.
Yes. The executive and legislative branches are locked in a really intense battle right now, and the friction is playing out across multiple fronts simultaneously.
Let's look at the mechanics of the $1.8 billion fund. This is covered extensively across the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times.
Right.
The Trump administration proposed a $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund. The stated purpose was to compensate political allies, including individuals involved in the January 6th riot, who claimed they were wrongfully prosecuted or investigated by the government.
To understand how this died, you really have to look at the legislative maneuvering. The administration tried to attach this fund as an amendment to a broader immigration funding bill.
Okay.
But it triggered a major revolt within their own party. In the Senate, Republicans like Susan Collins, John Husted, and Dan Sullivan broke ranks. They sided with Democrats to successfully vote down the amendment, effectively stripping the fund out of the bill entirely.
And the fallout from that vote created immediate chaos within the executive branch itself.
How so?
Well, Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche went before a House committee and testified under oath that the plan for the fund is completely dead. But almost simultaneously, President Trump told reporters in the Oval Office that he wasn't sure if it was dead or just on hold. He literally said, "I think it's so important."
It is highly unusual for a sitting president to publicly undermine the sworn testimony of his own acting attorney general on the exact same day.
Yeah, that's definitely not the norm.
And it complicates the next move because the Washington Post reports that President Trump plans to nominate Blanche as the permanent attorney general.
Oh, wow.
This sets up a brutal confirmation battle in the Senate, especially with those lawmakers who just revolted over the very fund Blanche was being asked about.
The gears are just grinding against each other everywhere you look in D.C. We also have former National Security Advisor John Bolton reaching a tentative deal to plead guilty to mishandling classified information.
This was over a book, right?
Yeah, a book critical of the president. He's facing a $1.25 million fine and up to 5 years in prison. And over in the House, USA Today reports they voted to block Trump's war powers regarding the ongoing conflict with Iran, with four Republicans crossing the aisle to advance the measure.
Beyond the legislative blocks, there are profound questions being raised about the administration's economic mechanics.
The ballroom project.
Exactly. The Washington Post published a deep dive into the president's $400 million White House ballroom project. According to a government watchdog group, 14 of the 27 known corporate donors to this project have won new or expanded federal contracts.
And the scale of those contracts is wild.
Right. They're worth over $50 billion in just the last 6 months.
And it's not just the contracts that are raising eyebrows. It's the regulatory relief. The report notes that many of those same corporate donors recently had federal enforcement actions against them suspended.
To explain how that works mechanically, it means regulatory agencies like the EPA or the SEC suddenly paused active investigations or waived pending fines for these specific companies.
Just pause them.
Yep. Critics are pointing to this timeline as a glaring mechanical example of pay-to-play corruption, where donations to a pet project result in immediate federal leniency and lucrative contracts.
And this gridlock, it isn't confined to legislation and economics. It's directly hitting cultural institutions. The Washington Post and USA Today note that a federal judge ordered President Trump's name removed from the Kennedy Center.
And that legal order triggered a massive logistical freeze. By blocking the naming rights, the judge effectively blocked the planned renovations that were tied to those rights.
Right, and the direct casualty of that freeze is the National Symphony Orchestra. Because the venue renovations are now in legal limbo, the orchestra can't book the hall.
Oh, man.
If they can't book the venue, they can't sell their seasonal subscriptions. Their entire operating budget is frozen because of a dispute over whose name goes on the building.
That's a huge ripple effect.
And meanwhile, the FDA is launching a 6-month safety study on the abortion pill mifepristone, which administration officials indicate could pave the way for future restrictions on its distribution.
The sheer volume of these battles is overwhelming the system's capacity to function.
Looking at all this gridlock, it feels less like the normal healthy friction of checks and balances and more like, I don't know, a computer where 100% of the processing power is going to the background operating system conflicting with itself.
Right.
There is zero CPU power left to actually run any new applications. Am I reading too much into that?
No, that is a highly accurate analogy. The system was designed by the founders to create friction, to prevent any one branch from moving too quickly.
Right, it's a feature, not a bug.
Exactly. But material fatigue is setting in. When foreign policy is litigated through funding bills, when an orchestra season hinges on a federal judge's ruling about naming rights, the CPU isn't just running hot. In many places, it is seizing up entirely.
And when the mainframe freezes at the top, the downstream users feel it. We're moving now from the high-stakes battles of Washington to how these sweeping economic and cultural shifts actually hit your wallet, your media diet, and your local communities.
Because the macro politics always dictate the micro realities.
Let's ground the economics in something millions of households are dealing with right now. Their pets.
Yeah.
USA Today has a piece noting that Americans spend a staggering $158 billion on their pets.
That's incredible.
But right now, animal adoptions are dropping significantly because veterinary costs are just surging. They shared this story of Olivia Sablin. She's a postdoctoral student in Seattle. She rescued a golden retriever named Lemon.
Oh.
And she's having to actively cut her own grocery budget just to afford the $119 a month it costs for Lemon's basic care.
It's a perfect microeconomic indicator. Inflation and supply chain issues aren't just, you know, abstract numbers discussed in congressional hearings. They trickle down and force everyday people to make these heartbreaking, granular choices at the kitchen table.
Do I buy fresh groceries or do I get my dog's medicine?
Exactly.
We also see this trickle-down effect in the lens through which we view the world. Both the LA Times and the Wall Street Journal are covering a massive internal shakeup at CBS's 60 Minutes.
This is a huge media story.
It really is.
Yeah.
Scott Pelley, their most high-profile correspondent, was just fired. And the mechanics of this dismissal are deeply tied to the political friction we were just discussing.
Right.
Pelley openly clashed with CBS News editor-in-chief Barry Weiss's and the new executive producer, Nick Bilton. He was essentially accusing network leadership of altering the program's editorial stance to placate the Trump administration.
When a flagship news program experiences this level of internal turmoil over political alignment, it alters the very fabric of the media landscape.
It changes everything.
It changes what stories are told, how questions are framed, and ultimately, how millions of Americans understand their own reality.
And the physical reality of our cities is getting a bit of whiplash, too. The Wall Street Journal reports that the statue wars are running in reverse.
In reverse.
Yeah. Back in 2020, during the George Floyd protests, Columbus, Ohio took down a 22-foot, 3-ton statue of Christopher Columbus.
Right, I remember that.
Well, now, traditionalist groups are actively suing and lobbying local governments to resurrect these memorials. And that specific 3-ton statue in Ohio is likely making a comeback.
It's the pendulum swing of culture. The physical monuments erected or dismantled in our public parks are really just delayed reflections of the prevailing political winds.
But the starkest example of political downstream effects today comes from the New York Times reporting on Venezuela.
Yes, the situation there is wild.
Following the U.S. forces ousting President Maduro back in January, the capital city, Caracas, is seeing an absolute economic boom. Oil men and crypto tycoons are flooding the city, and it's flush with international investment.
That sounds like a gold rush.
It does. But just a drive away, the industrial city of Cumaná is described as a broken-down shell. There is no drinking water. They suffer daily blackouts. Residents are literally reduced to scavenging in garbage dumps just to survive. One local economist joked grimly that their city looks like Kyiv, even though there were no bombings.
It's a tale of two cities dictated entirely by regime change. The new leadership brought immediate international investment to the center of power, but the decades of disastrous economic management left the rest of the country hollowed out.
A new president in the capital doesn't instantly fix the plumbing in Cumana.
Exactly.
So, what does this all mean? It means that whether you are looking at the surging cost of keeping your golden retriever healthy, the sudden return of a 3-ton statue to your local park, the firing of the journalist you watch on Sunday nights, or the literal survival of an industrial city. The macro politics dictate our micro realities.
Yeah.
The invisible wind moves the visible world.
The decisions made in corner offices and the Oval Office inevitably end up on your kitchen table. The connections are always there if you look for them.
Absolutely. To wrap up today's deep dive, I want to pull back from the present moment for a second. I want to look at an incredible piece from USA Today about the upcoming anniversary of D-Day.
Oh, this is a great story.
Specifically, the story of Group Captain James Martin Stagg. He was the chief meteorologist for General Eisenhower in 1944. And the amount of pressure on this single individual was just unimaginable.
I can't even fathom it.
Right. Operating without weather satellites, without computer modeling, without radar. He had to rely on scattered surface observations from ships and his own intuition. And against the advice of his colleagues, he advised Eisenhower to delay the massive invasion of Normandy by one single day.
From June 5 to June 6.
Exactly, due to storms he tracked coming across the Atlantic.
He changed the course of world history based on a tiny fraction of the information we take for granted today, which raises a profound question when we compare it to the world we've been discussing for the last 15 minutes.
Where does that leave us?
Well, in 1944, a meteorologist made a world-altering decision with almost no data. Today, we are drowning in data.
We really are.
We have AI algorithms predicting our societal risks. We have researchers identifying microscopic blood proteins, predicting our cancers 5 years in advance. We have endless polling and economic modeling predicting our politics.
Everything is mapped out.
But does having infinitely more information actually make us any better at making world-altering decisions? Or does it just make us more paralyzed by the infinite possibilities?
That is the question to sit with. Are we seeing the wind? Or are we just staring at a million bending leaves? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the information around you, and we will see you next time.